Thank you very much. Welcome to McNally Jackson Books. As you can see, one of the really most wonderful bookstores in New York, and we're very well, we feel very welcome here. Thanks so much, Michelle Philgate, who set this up and runs the programs here. I'm very pleased to be presenting the author of Aboard the Democracy Train, A Journey Through Pakistan's Last Decade of Democracy. Nafisa Hoodboy is a pioneering journalist, the only woman who was reporting on the ground in Pakistan under General Zia. She worked for Dawn, the English language newspaper, and she has been an eyewitness to a history that has impacted all of us. I first met her in 2002, about 6 months after the events of September 11th, when WNYC was looking at how the city had changed, was looking at really the implications of that attack. And if some of you may not know, but the largest number of deportees in New York City at that time were Pakistanis. They were being sent to detention centers. And so we were looking for somebody who could help us get that story, somebody who was an Urdu speaker, someone who could really bring us into that world. And that's how I first met Nafisa. She at that point really, you know, took cab rides and basically found, helped us find that story and report it to our listeners. And in the course of that, she began thinking about this book, and that's really where we're going to start. Also joining us tonight is Professor Henry Chip Carey, who is he's a political science professor at Georgia State University, author of at least two books. One is Privatizing the Democratic Peace. The other is Reaping What You Sow, a comparative examination of torture reform in the U.S., France, Argentina, and Israel. He met Nafisa. He was working on emerging democracies and was in Pakistan and did some research there, and that's how they met. So welcome, and we're going to have a discussion and then ask for some questions. So Nafisa, first off, congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what you set out to do with this book.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating that I'm actually inaugurating or launching this book in New York City, where I first began my career in journalism. And I would say that I was so inspired by the women's movement here that it did, you know, move me on to become the only woman reporter under General Zia-ul-Haq. And this was a period when Benazir Bhutto was aspiring to become the only woman prime minister of Pakistan, and I was deputed to cover her. And that's where the book actually begins.
And when you were in New York at that time, had you studied history, had grown up in Karachi, but decided that journalism was the path for you to really do the work that you wanted to do?
I always wanted to be a journalist, but journalism for me had to be exciting. And and I think the U.S. wasn't exciting enough. And that was the reason why I went back. And actually, it was also to make a difference. You know, being the only woman reporter was different.
Describe the scene. The book is really rich with details, but describe the scene of what it was like to walk into a newspaper room in Karachi. Their women were not reporters, correct? They were behind the desk. They were in editorial positions. And just describe what that experience was like.
Well, there were women, but, you know, they were behind desks. And I think I didn't want to be sitting at a desk. And I aspired to be a reporter. And fortunately, I got the break. But the newspaper I worked at, you know, just had middle-aged men. And I was the only woman at that stage, which was very different, very exciting.
Do you think that your experience, certainly the women's movement here changed a lot of roles for women also in the U.S., but maybe just talk a little bit about your background, because it seems to me that you also had a kind of, you came from an extraordinary home.
I would say my father was extremely liberal and open to new ideas and encouraged his girls to take up different professions. And I had a lot of support from my home, and definitely that was a big start.
Right, and so that moment was possible. So talk about... Yeah, go ahead,
Chip. I was just going to say that when I met Nafisa and other journalists at the Press Club in Karachi, which was a really... an interesting place.
And what year was this?
1990. It's the second set of elections that Benazir ran in and was defeated after her government was quashed by the president. But I was just going to point out that Nafisa, when you talk about the benefits of gender mainstreaming, brought a whole host of new subjects to the Dawn newspaper, and then later it was copied by Newsline and Herald, the magazines of record in the English language. She had an advantage of writing in English in that the generals were a lot more tolerant, and I say the generals because they were still in charge as well as senior civil servants, because the masses don't read anything but the Urdu press that comes out at 6 a.m. or other non-English languages. But she covered a whole range of human rights stories, which I think were never covered by Dawn before, the Kuwait kidnapping rings that were linked to the political parties were Nafisa's own range of stories that she was following at the time. She adopted the doctors who were always going on strike. And in Pakistan, you know, the women doctors serve women and the men doctors serve men, so you need to have a lot of women doctors. And they're, along with the lawyers and journalists, I would say they're almost become social movements in the country, quite unlike in the United States, where they fight for things that are incredibly important and never taken up. And I think Nafisa's journalism was really, it's a cliche to use this term, but path-breaking.
Yeah.
Well, that was the thing that, you know, the fact is that there was a movement to ghettoize women's issues, which I think is worldwide, you know, to put women in their place. And I was initially given the beat of women, and which meant covering a certain, you know, path. And I really had to fight to get out of that. And I think I got my first break when Benazir Bhutto aspired to become the only woman prime minister, which is, you know, which is how I begin my book, that in 1988 I traveled with her aboard the democracy train as the only woman reporter who's then getting beyond the confines of being a woman and having had the advantage of covering a woman aspiring to be the next prime minister. So that was my big break. And of course, you know, during the break, I come across a number of interesting stories, which I put in this book.
Describe what that, really what that train trip was like, and just how politics were practiced at that time and how Benazir practiced them, what the campaigning was like and what it was like to be out in the countryside meeting the crowds and what the response was to her.
Well, the fact is that Benazir Bhutto was the daughter of the executed Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and for the grieving masses, she was the icon, the person who could redeem the excesses of the military regime. And so people came out in the millions to greet her. You know, it was such a scene that I think the photograph on my book actually captures some of it. But people danced in the streets. People, you know, were overjoyed at the fact that a woman could actually overthrow a dictator and take over and bring democratic rule. Of course, it never happened, but that was the view.
The Bhutto family, I mean, for those of you who are not, I mean, extremely familiar with the role of politics, their story, their family story reads like a, you know, some kind of epic novel. And Benazir's husband is now the president of Pakistan. They have had such a huge footprint in politics there. And she was seen as a reformer, and yet, of course, there was a tremendous amount of corruption within her initial campaign. Can you just talk about that the role of corruption in politics? She was seen as a potential mm-hmm. person who was going to make a difference there, and yet that really didn't come to fruition.
That is a fact. I mean, the fact of the matter is that perhaps Benazir tried to go over, you know, the set norms, and perhaps as a populist leader, she didn't imbibe the type of corruption that was present there in the system. But unfortunately, any politician who wishes to succeed in Pakistan, they have to contend with two things, crime and corruption. And the two things are such an integral part of Pakistan's politics that any person who tries to sidestep them is sidelined. So consequently, in her first rule, in her first tenure, I would say in 1988, she gave tickets to the most oppressed people. She gave tickets to people who had been loyalists of the party, who had actually gone to prison and suffered.
Campaign nominations.
But she discovered very fast that trying to get these people didn't really serve her, that Pakistan is a deeply feudal and, you know, it has an entrenched feudal system, which means that if you do give campaign tickets, or how do you call them, if you do nominate somebody, it has to be somebody of a high standing. It has to be a big feudal lord. So we saw that in the second time round, she had nominated big feudal lords, because the first time round it didn't work. And so corruption kept slinking in. And I was a witness to the fact that the second time round she had hobnobbed with the bureaucrats, and she had, an in thing with the people who had been responsible for downing her in the first place.
Go ahead.
I think it's important to note that while the corruption in Bhutto's government was terrible, and she allowed Asif, her husband, to have free reign, it wasn't necessarily any worse than any other government. Mm-hmm. But in the culture, like a lot of corrupt political elite cultures around the world, it's the first thing you accuse them even before you have any facts. So it was a foregone conclusion when the establishment, which is the term used for the civil military bureaucracy, and Ghulam Isaac Khan, who was the president at the time, a civil servant getting $4,000 a year, but, you know, being worth tens of millions of dollars, not rupees. It was a foregone conclusion when they were going to get rid of Benazir. They were going to use the corruption charge to get rid of Benazir. They knew that Asif had taken these bribes on a number of deals, and he did. There's really no doubt about that. But it was all part of a strategy. Just like the decision to get rid of her was made months before, but 4 days after Saddam went into Kuwait, that was a time when they figured the Americans wouldn't be watching, so they dismissed GIK, this president, dismissed the government. It was all part of a strategy which unfortunately is so deeply institutionalized that you end up turning to the elites, as Nafisa just said, to provide your tickets, to run for office, to buy votes, in effect, to run the campaigns, in return that they're immunized from their own corrupt activities, and they make sure that their huge land holdings are never enforced. Quite the contrast with India, for example.
Which is interesting that Chip raised this point, because he and I had actually traveled to a small town in interior Sindh. In fact, we traveled to three towns together in 1990 when he had come to study emerging democracies. And the caretaker prime minister at that time, who was actually empowered to hold elections in 1990 as an alternate to Benazir's rule, because Benazir had been kicked out of power 2 years, she was elected in 1988, kicked out of power 2 years later, and the military decided to stick up an opposition to Benazir. And Chip was a witness to the fact that the ISI at that stage had actually given money to opposition politicians who would stand up against Benazir. Interestingly, that case was fought in the Supreme Court some 16 years ago, and it's going to come up for hearing at the end of this month, so you folks will know what it's going to be all about.
And the ISI, just explain, is the...
It's the Inter-Services Intelligence, which is actually the services, the intelligence wing of the military.
The same folks that give you the Taliban in Afghanistan and the various terrorist groups in Kashmir and have big expenses of their own to pay, including bribing agents all around the country and politicians. In this particular example, Jatoi, who was called uncle by the Benazir household, because in Pakistan you call your father's best friend, male friend's uncle, mm-hmm. and the female best friend's aunt, had been one of the founders of the Pakistan People's Party along with Bhutto himself, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And they'll turn on a dime. You pay somebody off. And this is a man who is the biggest landlord in Sindh. I don't know, 50,000 hectares wouldn't be half his landholdings probably. And, you know, we went to various places that are just undescribable. I mean, trip is full of memories. I mean, the biggest memory I have is just going past the deputy commissioner's house. The deputy commissioner, there are about 90 in the country, have a salary of 4,000 rupees. This was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But they have four full-time cars, each with a chauffeur. They have this mansion. The wall outside the mansion of this deputy commissioner was at least 2 kilometers, mile long. And I just thought to myself, and then we went to dinner and everybody stood up with this 40-course dinner but ate it in 10 minutes, which was just another one of these marvelous vignettes. I don't want to get on.
No, but Chip is mentioned in my book. In fact, that's the first chapter of my book if anyone's interested in reading about his experiences.
Do you think that, you talked about how much hope, a word in American politics as well, you know, Benazir brought in that campaign. Do you think she managed, and of course she was trying to go back and really once again play a role, do you think that there was any, was there any change under her rule? Was there any evidence that things made a difference to those people that were living out in the countryside, people that are really, really outside the system?
Well,
and specifically even just the fact that she was a woman who gained that, who did gain that role, did it change things for women at all?
Unfortunately not. I mean, the only thing that I think happened was the token significance of having a woman head a country, which is predominantly, you know, which has predominantly male values. The thing that she did do, which I think perhaps goes to keep the Bhutto name synonymous with populism, is that people who were kicked out of jobs were given jobs by her. There was a certain element of populism, and people all over the country always look to the Bhutto family and to the PPP as a savior and as a safeguard against being pushed out of jobs. But as far as women are concerned, no, there was nothing. There was really nothing. It was purely symbolic. And even the discriminatory laws which were passed by General Ziaul Haq, in which two women's testimony is considered to be equal to one man, and these are laws of evidence which are still on the books, they couldn't be repealed by her, which to me was a big paradox. How could you have a woman head of state who couldn't even sign her own name but would need another male witness to attest to her signature? So the paradoxes existed even while she was in power.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are many things that can be said. Obviously, she never had a full majority of the parliament, so it's not like a British two-party system. It's a coalition. There are many people out to get her just because she's a woman. It was very difficult to reverse the Shariat bill that Ziaul Haq had introduced. It's a very mild form of Sharia courts and law, but there are any number of things she could have done for the poor where it would have required budgetary resources. And 80% of the budget, at least, from the start of Pakistani history and continuing through her time, her two terms in office, was still 80% military plus foreign debt. And, you know, initially it wasn't the foreign debt, but the military gobbled up all the budget. like a lot of countries like Turkey and Indonesia, at least in the initial stages, the military line is not defined. So you just know the total amount, but you don't know where it's going. And it's impossible to get any democratic control unless you really push to democratize the review of legislation. What is often said are two things about Benazir. The first is that she's not going to democratize her own family. She passed on the right to head the Pakistan People's Party to her family as if it's
right.
an heirloom.
Right.
And the second thing that's said, they didn't hit the streets when her father was executed or assassinated, as Bhutto himself put it. And they didn't hit the streets when Bhutto's first government was dismissed, even mm-hmm. though the military surrounded the parliament building. Mm-hmm. In fact, she had this kind of yes-man people around her, so that even on the day when she was dismissed, she didn't find out about it till 2 in the afternoon, and it was on the 6 a.m. papers on the streets. And they didn't tell her that the army had surrounded the prime minister's house. And it just seems to me that she had certain priorities, and among the priorities was building a dynasty for his poor party, political maneuvering rather than policy substance. And that cost her the support of Punjabi poor people. She always has the Sindhis, but where she could grow the party's political base would have been to appeal to the very people that that idolized the progressive, socialism, were the three things.
Well, I mean, what I'd like to say is that, what Chip has touched on was not just a problem for Benazir, but has been a problem for all civilian governments, in the sense that it's always been the military that's controlled politics in Pakistan. And this is the thesis that I make in my book, that the military has always micromanaged politics. So it didn't make any difference if it was Benazir or Nawaz Sharif. The 10 years of democracy that I've covered in the book have been interspersed by four civilian rulers coming in and out of power. So I call it a case of musical chairs. And it's literally, whose turn is it now to get into power? This present regime, I would say the PPP government, has managed to cling on to power by the sheer skin of their teeth. Every day the judiciary is about to sack them. But because I think Zardari is a better player than Benazir was, being more shrewd, being a businessman who's able to make more deals than his wife, that he's managed to now pull on for 4 years. But Benazir had no such luck, no such ability.
I mean, we're watching, such extraordinary change go through the Arab world. We're watching other countries overthrow military strongholds. There's been one, often in those cases, one leader in charge. Do you think that are there stirrings of that in Pakistan? Is there some sense that it would be possible, or is the ISI so entrenched and just too well funded?
I think what has changed in the last 10 years is that there's been a stirring at the lower levels. So, for example, the judiciary has become very strong, and the Chief Justice, when he had the gall to stand up against Pervez Musharraf, the military ruler, that was an exceptional move. Hundreds of thousands of people rallied after the Chief Justice. Interestingly, I write about this in the third section of my book, because Benazir perceived him as a rival, given the fact that now she was in exile while hundreds of thousands of people were following the Chief Justice. Meanwhile, she was just a lonely figure trying to find out her place back in Pakistan. So when she returned to power, and I do write about this in the third segment, the first thing she wanted to do is get rid of the Chief Justice. Hmm. And, it's clearly a case of power politics that two chiefs can't exist in the same space at the same time. And the judiciary, unfortunately, has been hedged. It's been given a tough time right now, because the People's Party would really would like to carry on their business, without the judiciary interfering. But the judiciary has the support of the people. So you have a very complex situation. But I do see that as a positive thing, because there are people behind the judiciary, and the re-election of the Chief Justice was a positive thing on the whole for the country.
Yeah. I agree with all of that. I do think that the military really is entrenched in a way that becomes doubly powerful, because the political elites in the country, predominantly feudal lords with massive land holdings, know that when push comes to shove, the military needs the political elites basically to support their agenda, and they know that they can't push that agenda. So you have to look for cracks in the system, and the only cracks can either come from below or from the judiciary, it would seem. And the judiciary has some limited abilities to make some major constitutional decisions, upholding or striking down even decisions by this military-civil establishment. Between the civil servants and the military officers and the political elites, the game in Pakistan really doesn't have too many cracks in it, and you're not going to see massive reforms until you get the kind of mass movements that actually Zulfi Bhutto were leading and then Benazir were leading momentarily. But it makes it so difficult for them to sustain that kind of movement from below that the lawyers' movement have been almost the most successful. And, the military is quite willing to assassinate dozens of protesters in cold blood. And it's happened in a couple of these lawyers' rallies. And, it's like any of these authoritarian regimes. They don't mass murder. They just kill enough to send a signal that you're risking your life to go out there. And it's a pretty effective way, because it's not enough mass killings to get the attention of the world media or the diplomats.
Well, actually, I would disagree with that. I mean, the fact is, in the lawyers' movement, the military did not really move in for the kill.
They armed MQM, who killed them.
Where it's happened is in Balochistan. It's the province where an insurgency is going on right now, and there is a movement for secession from the rest of the federation. And there's a really alarming situation over there. In fact, this was debated recently by representatives of Congress in Washington, D.C. I don't think, foreign countries should really interfere in Pakistan's affairs, but I do think that just bringing the issue before Congress was positive in the sense of drawing media attention. And to that extent, I think that it's really important to stress that right now people are being picked up for fighting for their own nationalistic rights, for fighting for control of their own resources. And these people are being picked up by the military, are being disappeared, and their bodies are being found in the province. This is an extremely alarming situation and a very recent development. I do touch upon that, but the conditions in the last 10 years were gradually leading up to it, and right now it's reached a point where there's literally a slaughterhouse in the Balochistan province, which on the border of Iran.
And the Baloch are also, causing problems for the Iranian government, and they did cause problems for Zia before. I was just referring to the peaceful protests for democracy. They don't mass murder. Obviously, they do mass murder in Balochistan, and Zia mass murdered. I think there were a fair number of unaccounted murders by Zia also against the Movement for the Restoration of Democracy, which, Jatoy, who was then with Bhutto, was one of the organizers of, but then he became the perpetrator for the movement against democracy by supporting the dismissal of Benazir's government. So these political elites will switch sides on a dime when it's politically convenient for them personally. That's what the kind of constraint that makes the democracy movement very difficult to be effective.
You also describe, Nafisa, just the cultural, the way that people live on this land, that they have there's mostly a feudal system, as you describe it.
Right.
People are toiling on land that they don't own, and that they have no hope of owning or really getting a stake in. And culturally, they're really bound. Women don't have much freedom. Can you give just people a sense of? It also seems that there are really several different ethnic groups which also get involved in the political process, and those ethnic groups then rally around their candidates, and that seems to, in my read of the book, keep a coalescing of really a sort of unified Pakistan.
Right. Well, I mean, I would take a step back because this is how I begin my book. The introduction is basically the fact that Pakistan was carved out of India in 1947. And I was born after partition, but as I begin the book, I point out that it was the influx of millions of Indian refugees, they are called Muhajirs, into Sindh and into Karachi, where they converged to earn a livelihood, that led to this intense ethnic conflict that we see in the country today. Because subsequently, the Muhajirs were then banded into the MQM. And the MQM is a party which has been used by the military to divide the vote between Sindhis, who tend to support the Pakistan People's Party, and the MQM, whose leader, incidentally, lives in London, Altaf Hussain. But because of the MQM becoming so strong, other ethnic parties like the Punjabis and the Pashtuns have created their own ethnic parties. And because the pie is small and because these ethnic parties converge in Karachi, they have constantly fought with each other over just the right to livelihood. And I was a witness to the type of struggles that, you know, ensued between these ethnic groups. And of course, when you have violence, and one more thing that I would like to add here is that I was a witness to weapons coming in during the Cold War. And when these weapons fell into the hands of these ethnic groups, the type of bloodshed that we saw in the 80s and 90s actually arose from Western nations dumping, you know, arms and ammunition into that part of the world.
Right. This was the proxy war that we were sending arms in because the Soviet Union had come into Afghanistan. And so those arms were then making their way into Pakistan.
Well, they come right in through Karachi.
Right.
The naval base port there is, you know, it sounds conspiratorial in, but it's drugs going out, arms going in. And who's managing the naval base? The army. You know, it's not written about very much, but the military and various other elements in Pakistan are profiting on the drug trade and the arms trade. And it destroyed the country.
I would
this
say
is the drug trade coming down through Afghanistan? This is
how do the drugs get out of Afghanistan to Europe and the United States? They got to get on a ship at some point.
So they go through Karachi?
Yeah.
Well, I would say that arms and drugs have always been the mainstay of these ethnic groups, you know, who fought for autonomy and control of their turf inside Karachi. But the arms were actually pilfered by the ethnic groups in during the Cold War. And right now, even now, when America is so deeply involved in Afghanistan, you can imagine that the transit trade continues and that drugs continue to be smuggled across the border and become a source of supply, not only for the Taliban, but for ethnic groups who can lay their hands on it.
The other thing I would say in regard to some of these issues is that the military encourages the militarization of the political parties. So Benazir had her bodyguard, but she also had her militia, and then they had her student wing. And I only mention Benazir because her was the party that was supposed to be the Democratic Party. All the others have their student wings, which become violent soon after they graduate from university, if not in university, because a lot of these killings even occur there. And so you have political...
And so they are the students are recruited while they're in school? How does that work?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they have... The PPP have a student federation on the various campuses, but so would the MQM, so would the Muslim League, so would a lot of the Islamic fundamentalist parties, Jamaat-e-Islami and some of their other counterparts, all have student wings. That's a different strategy. That's long-term recruitment, low profile at work to be mobilized when the time is right, or feeding students into the jihads in the various parts.
So
but the standard parties have, you know, violent wings, corrupt wings, beginning with, you know, the party militia that engage in these massacres in Karachi, as well as the student wings.
And so if you're an ambitious student or a good student, this is really the path for you to have a future and
Well, it's one path. It's not the only path. But it's almost, in some countries, you ask, why do Democrats participate in coups? why do they get involved in all these guns? And it, you can say it was a defensive reaction. Right? She'd be the only party without a student wing that's armed. And they're killing your party. They do selective assassinations of your party workers, or disappearing your party workers out in the middle of the interior where nobody will ever hear about it.
Yeah, we will be. But do you have the time, Nafis? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's about 7:45.
Oh, okay. I guess the one question that I just wanted to ask was the American policy now and America's interaction with Pakistan. And I'm just curious, really, what the sense in Pakistan right now is, what the feeling is on the street in terms of what they think about the U.S. and how we are interacting?
Well, I think it's been a really grievous situation because, you know, in the last 10 years, something like 40,000 people have been killed in Pakistan in the war on terror. And these are not just by drone attacks. These have resulted from revenge killings by militant groups on the military. You know, the military had patronized certain militant groups, and there was blowback, which I also talk about in the book. But generally, the loss of life, the loss of livelihood, I mean, Pakistan has suffered very deeply because of this war on terror. Because of the instability, livelihood has been deeply affected. And so you can imagine the level of anti-Americanism that has been created as a result of this, because the U.S., Pakistan was dragged into this war. It was really an unwilling partner, I would say, of the United States, according to Musharraf. And Musharraf is quoted as saying that we were told that if we didn't participate in this war, we would be nuked back into the last century. So Pakistan adopted a policy of subterfuge. That is, on the surface, it appeared to be moving along as a U.S. ally. But in fact, you know, it kept its hand on the Afghan Taliban because, of course, it has to look at to its own strategic interests. And so right now, the military's anti-U.S., people are anti-U.S., and you can imagine that when there are public rallies held in Pakistan, Imran Khan's rally maybe, you have to suspect that there is something pro-military in them which allows them to mobilize people on such a large level. So right now the atmosphere is very anti-US and very unfriendly to Americans.